this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and the views of our guest is Melody Cederstrom, who supports Radio Liberty. We support her in her effort to educate people about what's going on. And these indeed are fascinating times from a financial point of view, and we try to keep our listeners abreast of what's going on. Now, during this last week, one of the Arab countries, Kuwait, has announced it's no longer going to peg its currency to the American dollar. In other words, what we've always feared is that some of the Arab countries or other countries would stop pegging their currencies to the American dollar, would cease to be the reserve dollar, reserve currency for the world, and trillions, tens of trillions of dollars would come flooding home here and destroy the value of our currency. Well, the first country is Kuwait. Now we know that Syria's moving away from the dollar as well. Venezuela is certainly threatening to do the same thing. We know that this last week, Morgan Stanley put out a triple sell order. In other words, they told their clients to sell, sell, sell. They believe that everything was in place for a real serious correction on the stock market, and we saw the stock market drop dramatically over a period of several days here, and it bounced back a little bit today. Faced with all the problems in the world and the weakness of the American dollar, why, of course, gold should have gone up, and silver should have gone up, and instead they fell in face of the massive selling across the country. Things really don't quite fit into place, do they, Melody?
No, they certainly don't. And today was just the perfect picture of manipulation, because basically the market should have continued to fall today. And I believe gold will turn around, and I think we'll see a gold turn around next week. Anything's possible, but I believe we'll see that, because so often we expect gold to react immediately to the things that are happening in the markets around the world, whether they be economically or militarily. And sometimes you will get that immediate reaction when something is, based on military wars and rumors of wars. But so many times things have to be filtered through the system. People have to sit back, pause, and think, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't have sold our gold and so forth. But there was some, the ETFs did a lot of selling of gold. But what's interesting, though, is when everybody is beginning to panic about gold, you have, I believe it was J.P. Morgan, come out, and they're talking about gold rising to $1,000. It's always the case. The big financial institutions, they will make money on gold, just like the central banks. They're buying gold. They don't allow a few dollars correction in the market deter them from not purchasing gold and accumulating it.
Well, you know, Chris, they keep talking about selling it. I mean, we hear the central banks are selling gold, so everything is just so confusing. But we do know that there are massive shorts on gold and silver, both in the Tokyo Exchange, on the American Exchange, and it's all manipulation. It is illegal to do what they're doing. But who are we going to complain to? The Japanese government? To our own Federal Reserve System, which is complicit in working with the banks and certainly other people to manipulate prices? Just like they tell us there's no inflation. There's no inflation, 2%. They're not telling the truth. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, go ahead, Melody. You know, there have been some reports now from some fairly reliable people recently estimated the inflation rate's about 10% rather than the 2.5% we're being told. Have you heard any of those rumors at all?
Oh, absolutely. But I just wanted to make a comment on the central banks that were selling gold. It's true, they have sold, and they'll probably reach closer to their 500 tons that they're allotted to sell. But really, their selling didn't have that much of an impact on it, on the price of gold. It's usually more of a psychological impact. And when you have the G8 meeting, I'm sorry, there's no such thing as coincidences. So everything is staged to set up to create that psychology of, in order for them to be able to manipulate the price of gold as they have. I believe everything is a stage, and they do have an agenda.
Well, I believe
there are no coincidences. So with the selling of the banks, and there's reports coming out that the on Thursday you had there was heavy overnight sales of German and government bonds, and we had auctions on our bonds, and it's been very weak. And so people don't want our debt anymore. And it's not so much perhaps that they're selling their interest in the dollar, but they're not buying anymore. There's some incredible numbers that came out that shows where overseas central banks have sold their holdings of treasury and other agency debts, Wednesday and Thursday. And some of those foreign institutions also sold securities in the from government-sponsored agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the numbers, I mean, we're talking like $2.7 billion from their holdings. And there's a lot of things that are going on, and I think we're going to have an incredible, exciting week next week.
Well, you know, on one hand, the central banks say that they're selling, and then, of course, but they never tell us who buys. That's the amazing thing, and I suspect you're absolutely right. On one hand, they're making a very big issue out of selling to drive the price down. On the other hand, I mean, how many people could buy 50 or 100 tons of gold? I don't know any of my friends who could. So obviously it's got to be people with a great deal of wealth in the central banks who are actually buying it. They sell with one hand, they buy with the other, and it is all designed to confuse the public so they can't figure out what's really going on. But I will tell you that they know we're in real trouble and the dollar is in trouble. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Melody was simply talking about what's happening. Some of the people throughout the world are beginning to divest themselves of dollars. Even more interesting was a recent report in the Wall Street Journal that pointed out that a number of other countries and people in other countries with large dollar holdings are coming to the United States and buying up our major industries. Now, we know that they've already bought up about 25%. Of our major manufacturing. That is, still has not been moved overseas. And they've come in and they've bought up Westinghouse, and if you get our financial tsunami syllabus, you'll see page after page after page after page after page of American corporations that have been bought up and are still operating here in the United States. But apparently, just recently, and we're talking about within the last month or so, they're coming in and even buying up more and more of our major industries, and the reason they're doing it is they have the dollars, and of course they're falling in value. They've lost 25 or 30% in value over the last year and a half. What are you going to do with them? I mean, you don't want to keep hanging on to them if you're convinced the dollar is going to drop another 30 or 40%. So they're coming in here and buying up property. They're coming in here and buying up businesses and other things that have intrinsic value. Because they realize, of course, that money has no intrinsic value when there's nothing behind it. It's a fiat money system. And so apparently people with a great deal of money are either coming in here and buying up our manufacturing, old grocery stores, property, And the big boys, the George Soros's, the Bill Gates, the Warren Buffett, are getting their money out of this country and into other currencies. Have you heard that?
Sure, they've been doing it, and you're right. We have foreigners that are building up, buying up our infrastructures. They're buying up our toll rolls, toll roads. It's late here in the East, actually. They're buying up toll roads. They're buying up, all different types of infrastructure. We have the China, who now is invested in Blackstone, I believe it is.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, and it's just a way in which they can backdoor the U.S. Now they can go and buy up whatever they want, and, you know, the normal public out there, they just don't have a clue what's going on.
Well, last year our trade deficit was $800 billion. I mean, it started out with a maybe $25 billion trade deficit, and every year it would go up $50 or $100 billion. So last year, in the year 2006, our trade deficit was $800 billion. In other words, we bought $800 billion more than we actually exported, our federal government's having to borrow money every single day just to keep afloat, and yet we still are wasting money and sending foreign aid to other countries. We're sending foreign aid to Russia, massive amounts of foreign aid to Russia in one form or another, and they have something like $400 billion in reserves. Why would you send aid and lend money to countries like China and Russia that have massive reserves? And we go over there to China, guaranteeing this $5 billion loan so that the Westinghouse can build some gigantic nuclear plants. They're building 5 nuclear plants over there, and Westinghouse isn't even an American company; it's a Japanese company that. Well, Sydney still operates in the United States, but the profits don't stay here. They go back to Japan. And nobody ever asks the questions, why are we doing these things? They just don't make sense. And if they don't make sense, then there has to be another explanation.
It doesn't make sense. And I really don't believe, I believe this is going to have to play itself out, because I don't believe our politicians have what it takes to make the decisions in order to change things around. I mean, that goes back to tariffs, that goes back to putting some kind of quotas on the types of and kinds of products that come into this country, and turning around and begin manufacturing that again. And I don't think we have the skill. We don't have the labor force anymore. It's not like we used to have, you know, the old timers, the old engineers that had their apprentices, and you know, they would train and pass it on all their knowledge about and their tools. They're changing their what do you call it, when they tool the machinery and so forth. We don't have trained workers anymore to do that, not like we did at one point in time. So even if the politicians were able to make these changes and put quotas, and I'm not sure we'd be able to turn those manufacturing plants around anymore. So many of them have turned into craft stores. They've turned into different types of retails, because that's all we do anymore. We're just a service economy anymore. So, and it's sad when you go past these, particularly in Pennsylvania, when you go past the Bethlehem steel plants. I mean, they used to be, I remember as a child going by them, and they had all kinds of things going on. You had the railroad tracks going into the plants, and you had the trains and being filled with the products, and and now they're ghost towns, or they're selling crafts, and this is what has happened to our country, and they're not complete with it. And someone brought to my attention today, he said to me, you know, he says, these globalists, you know, they're aging. And he says they're on a fast track because they want to see a lot of what they began in their younger days to complete. They want to see some sort of completion of their...
this whole diabolical plan, and the diabolical plan really is the destruction of the economy of America, because they hate the United States. And when you understand that there are people in positions of power who hate our country, who want to do away with our national sovereignty, who want to impoverish our people, and if you doubt that, you need to read the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out of the Second Earth Summit, and it's summarized in our Sustainable Development Syllabus, but you can get the original text, the Global Biodiversity Assessment, published by Cambridge University Press, where they talk about the only way we can have so many people in the world is to get the living standards down to that of the people living in Eastern Europe. Well, the people in Eastern Europe at the time are pretty much peasants, very, very low living standards, and that is what they really intend for America. And people say, that can't happen here. And I would ask, why can't it happen here? We're moving rapidly towards a two-tiered society, the very wealthy, and then, of course, the military and police class and the bureaucracy that'll keep the peasants in line, and then we're going to wipe out the middle class. We're wiping out their pensions. We're destroying the value of their currency. We're making their jobs really don't pay well. And the good-paying jobs are all leaving. For our young people, of course, if you go to the colleges, I was reading an article recently about this gentleman who was attending the graduation of one of our best colleges where they were simply giving out PhDs. But they weren't giving them out to American students. They were all foreign students who'd come to America, and so many of them would be going back to the country of origin, to China, to India, to other countries throughout the world. And he said it was just amazing. There were no American students there. They were getting their PhDs because our students really are not that good. And they cannot compete, in many instances, with the students from other countries today. So this is the real tragedy, but the average American does not understand this is a result of long-range planning by people who have a different vision of America, because they really hate the United States and the freedom that it represented, I put in the past tense, because the way things are going, and with this latest series of presidential decisions, or presidential directives, I'm speaking of national security Presidential Directive 51 and Homeland Security Presidential Directive 20, both of which are available up on the White House page. You can get it off the internet. They were both signed very quietly on the 9th of May, allowing the president to establish a dictatorship indefinitely for any length of time he wants without congressional oversight. How could that happen in America? Well, it could happen, of course, because the media is not going to tell the American people the truth. Well, our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you have a question or comment about what's happening, well, Melody, are people continuing to get themselves into a defensive position? Do you think that the average person has any idea what's coming down the line as far as the collapse of our currency?
The average person doesn't. I believe they've been placed in a position in which they don't have a choice. They just kind of go with the flow, and they will accept anything that the government hands them if they feel that it is going to help them, just like socialized medicine and anything else that comes their way. They are ready to accept it. And I can always tell the difference because I do some advertising with another host, Raleigh James, and I can always tell when things happen that the calls from her program are less. So, I mean, we still have the general buyers of gold, the listeners who know what's going on. They continue to add and accumulate to their portfolios. But you can always tell the difference in questions, the difference in their excitement or their interest. So it definitely has an impact when you have, the pullbacks in the market. They don't care about you. People need to really protect themselves.
name is Zavala. Our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And if you have a question for Melody, give us a call. Well, I got a call from my fellow today. Actually, it was on my computer. He sent me a message. He said he had a lot of money in T-bond.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iOtterol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency, and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Price of milk. Look at the price of orange juice. Look at the price of meat and the things that you're buying. And they're all going up. Yes, the things we're buying from China have not gone up as much, although even those things that we get that are coming in the way of textiles and shirts and other things I mean, I can see the prices going up, but they're not going up that dramatically. But many of the things are going up. They tell you that, you know, what about the price of fuel? What about the price of electricity? What about the price of diesel? What about the price of gasoline? What was it a year and a half ago? What is it today? It's gone up over 30%. And how then do they come up with, we have a 2% inflation rate? It's very, very simple. It's how you can actually, play a game of golf that come in 10 under par. You cheat. And that's exactly what they do, of course, with the inflation rates. They simply lie to the American people. But the people who are in charge know what's going on. And I think they're really getting concerned about it. And if you listen to Ben Bernanke, he keeps talking about the danger of inflation. That's why he cannot lower the interest rates at all. Mm-hmm. And why I think that very, very soon they're going to have to start massively increasing the inflation rates. Either that or face losing the dollar completely. And maybe that's what they intend to do. Maybe, just maybe, that's why we're going to war with Iran and with the Muslim world. Because out of the chaos that would come, they could simply do away with the debt, and we could start in all over again.
And that's why they don't like gold, because ever since there wasn't a gold standard, there wasn't anything to hold the politicians back on Washington from spending and creating debt. And that's why the U.S. dollar is going to continue to fall, and it will be zeroed, and you're going to have the inflation that keeps rising. And it really doesn't matter, who's in Washington, it's going to continue to happen. We'd have to go back to a gold standard to change things. And whenever there's been a fiat currency, it doesn't matter what country, it doesn't matter who it was, it's always failed. And we will see our currency fail.
As Daniel Webster said, of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money.
Yeah.
Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. Daniel Webster lived from 1782 to 1852. Ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing new under the sun. And, of course, the trouble is that they don't teach you these things in school. We have a little pamphlet called The History of Money. We recommend that. It'll give you an overview of really what's going on and how this is not happening by accident. They know exactly what they're doing, and about once in every generation they end up impoverishing the people with the Great Depressions we had in the 30s, and then, of course, we can start it all over again. But during these times of redistribution of wealth, the rich get richer, the poor get poor, and, of course, really tremendous suffering. And the housing market is really beginning to shut down all across the country. One of the interesting things is in the condos in areas of Florida. People bought these condos a couple of years ago when they were still in the planning stage. And, now they're big multi-level condominium apartment houses are finishing up, and people have a $50,000 or $75,000 down payment on those, and now suddenly they find out that when they get them all completed, they're not going to be worth anywhere near as much as they're going to have to pay for them. And I understand that in many instances people are just walking away from those down payments, and the people who are building the Christian condominiums are wondering how they are going to be able to pay for them.
And there's one opportunity that people have to protect themselves against everything that is happening, from a dollar that is declining, from the economy that's going to be collapsing, and that's by buying gold and silver. And it's so simple. And yet it's so difficult to teach people how much better off they will have owning gold and silver than any type of investment, paper investment.
Well, of course, that's the lesson that's been learned down through the ages. The people here will learn the lesson. I just hope it won't be too late. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. We'd love to hear from you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and because we're hearing that in the areas, certain areas like San Diego and Las Vegas and Phoenix and other areas where there's just been a tremendous run-up in the price of condominiums or in homes, why, of course, now those properties are really beginning to drop rather dramatically. In areas where I live, of course, they really ran up. So far, there has not been a great fall-off because it's a very desirable place to live, but in many areas it's not too desirable. Why? There's been a tremendous backing away. Far more houses up for sale than are buyers, and certainly the prices, although haven't begun to drop dramatically, they are beginning to drop all across America, especially in areas where people want a lot of these adjustable rate mortgages. Then they lose their job, and then they suddenly find they can't make the house payments. And in fact, there are even beginning to be sites up on the internet where you can get lists of the houses in foreclosure. Never before in my memory has this happened. How about, do you remember anything like that, Melody?
No, I don't. And what's interesting, too, is, you know, for the past, 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, we've had rates relatively steady. So people on those adjustable rates have been able to adjust their finances. Now we see rates rising, and they're going to be hit with another couple hundred dollars per month on their monthly payments. So come this fall, I believe, you know, we'll see another, if you think the housing market is bad now, wait until this fall. And so as we see those rates rise, remember, all their mortgage monthly payments get readjusted higher and higher. And we've certainly seen the interest rates rise this week considerably. So,
how much were they up this week, Melody?
Actually, the 10-year hit today, I believe, 5.25, and it came back to close about 5.15, I believe. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I believe that's what it was. So earlier in the week, we started out at 4.85, I believe. So, I mean, they went up significantly. So,
of course, bond prices were down because the interest rates are up, and
right,
the two of them were inversely. And,
right.
And so when interest rates begin rising, the price of bonds begins to fall, and the people who put their money into bonds not only are losing out because of the inflation, they're losing out because the price of the bonds are falling, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Melody Cederstrom. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question for Melody, a question about anything we talk about, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. This is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And remember, I'm not a financial consultant. I'm simply a historian trying to warn people to prepare for difficult times. Melody, I'd like you to get your telephone number out, your website out, so people would know how to get in touch with you.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. My phone number is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. The website is Discount Gold and Silver Trading, trading.net. DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net. And if you have an email, if you would like to email us, if you have any questions, you can do so at DiscountGoldAndSilver@yahoo.com. And make sure you spell out AND on both the website and the email for DiscountGoldAndSilver@yahoo.com for the email.
All right, because we still have massive amounts of liquidity out there because, of course, every currency in the entire world is a fiat money currency. And some of these countries are just massively expanding their money supply. Why shouldn't they expand their money supply? It's really great to be able to make monopoly money and spend it. You can live so well, is what's been going on over in China. Problem is that China's got their economy so overheated. I mean, it was going up, you know, 2 or 3% a day. And everybody in China was getting into the stock market. Well, of course, they had a correction this last week, and apparently, you know, they were down almost 8% in a couple of days. In other words, the Chinese stock market is really began to contract, and the government was doing everything they could to cool off the economy, realizing that they were going to destroy the value of the currency if they didn't do it. And when you're dealing with a country with 1.25 billion people, you can't let the economy get too far out of line. So what happened to the Chinese economy? Did you hear what happened? Did they sort of stabilize things there after that that terrible fall off earlier in the week?
Well, I know this isn't funny, but I mean the government will—they'll come out and they'll say they're manipulating the prices, so or their stock market. And I guess they sort of learned the trick from our government, you know, on how to manipulate markets. And but they'll just come right out and tell you because they want the people to not be in there so heavy, and you know they don't want people in there, you know, actively buying stocks and everything. So they just manipulate it down and to cool things off. So.
Some people are saying we probably better stay out of the Chinese stock market for the time being. In fact, some people are saying that the best place to invest is certainly not the United States or China, but Brazil. They're talking about investments in Brazil, where the economy really is doing fairly well, and they seem to have a growing industrial base, of course, largely financed with your tax money. Ladies and gentlemen, do you realize how many hundreds of billions of dollars you've given to Russia? Mm-hmm. Do you realize how many hundreds of billions of dollars you've given to communist China? Do you realize how many hundreds of billions of dollars you've given to Brazil and other countries throughout the world as we have created money and debt and we've transferred our wealth to countries throughout the world? And when that money comes back cascading in here, it will simply destroy the value of everything. And I believe that's exactly what they intend.
I don't understand how people become so caught up, how they become so, and I do understand it because I call it the lottery mentality. They feel they're going to invest, you know, $10,000 and they're going to reap $500,000.
It is wonderful.
Truly. Pardon?
Is that wonderful if it's just true?
If it was just true, that's it. It's truly gambling, and I believe if we have inflation, we're going to have worldwide inflation. If our economy falls, the world economy is going to collapse. We're all interconnected. And so what happens here happens everywhere. There might be different degrees and at different periods of time, but as China, as these huge countries continue to absorb the commodities. I mean, they're building their infrastructures. They're building trainways. They're building trains. They're building railroads. They're building dams. They're building highways. They're taking all these commodities off the table, which means increased, more hyperinflation. So it's a worldwide problem. And therefore, they will have to adopt to a global currency, for lack of a better term for it. They will have to have a unit of trade of equal value, something that is consistent and not so easily manipulated like you have in the basket of currencies. So I do believe gold will be involved. It will be involved. Maybe they'll throw gold into the basket of currencies. I mean, the U.S. dollar will be replaced. So will it be replaced by another unit like the euro, or will it be replaced with a few currencies in a basket with some gold, or will it be a complete unit of trade of gold? These things will happen, and it's just a matter of we don't know when it will happen, but time is speeding up, and there's predictions and comments for 3 to 5 years.
I don't think we have that long, Melody.
I don't think so either.
We find other countries coming in and buying up the New Jersey Turnpike, the Ohio Turnpike, the Chicago Skyway. In fact, this gigantic highway that was the so-called NASCOM Highway that was rebuilt through Texas and on up into Kansas and then up into Canada. This was all going to be financed by a person, gigantic Spanish company, mm-hmm. tied to Spanish royalty, and the profits from that would accrue not here in the United States. Of course, it would be transferred to other countries. In other words, we would become simply a third world country working for other countries, as in the past other countries have been indebted to us, and their profits, of course, were funneled to the United States. But I fear that that day is gone. And, of course, have you had a chance to look at that article in Foreign Affairs magazine last month where they were talking about the coming global currency? If you have a chance to look, let me suggest you read it, because to me it was one of the most provocative articles. Now, for our listeners out there, there is an invisible government. Yep. These are the people who really rule, control both political parties. It is known as the Council on Foreign Relations, mm-hmm. which really regulates everything in this country. Of course, it's controlled by the Rockefellers. And if you read their magazine, Foreign Affairs, you'll get a pretty good idea of what's really going on. Sometimes the articles are very apropos, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're opinions, but you always want to consider what they're saying. And is this prophetic, or are they simply us putting things out to confuse you? But there was an article this last month, and I've tried to discuss this with several people who've read the article, but they did not read it very carefully.
Yeah.
And what they were basically saying is, certainly the current economic system, the financial system in the world, has failed. And the dollar is going to fail. The dollar is becoming increasingly worthless. There is going to have to be a new reserve currency for the world. And since, you know, we have to have something of intrinsic value, if people are ever going to trust currencies again, we need a gold-backed currency. But they are suggesting that since you can't trust countries to be responsible, this would be a privately issued gold-backed currency. If they just mentioned this once, I might have just sort of passed it by. But they mentioned the middle of the article, they mentioned it at the end of the article. And obviously, they were calling our attention to the possibility of a privately issued gold-backed currency. Now, remember, many years ago, currencies were privately issued. They were issued by banks, they were a medium of exchange, and the bankers were held legally to do what was right. That was supposedly the idea of the central banks. But, of course, the central bankers have used this system as a piggy bank for themselves to enrich the central bankers, but not to enrich the individual. Is it possible? Is it just possible they're considering a world currency that will be privately issued and backed by gold? If it does, of course, the price of gold would go right through the roof. So this is just something to contemplate. And I would recommend to our listeners out there, if you really care about the future, start reading Foreign Affairs magazine, as I have off and on for, I have the issues going back 45 years. I've been reading it. I don't read it as well as I could like to, but there's just so much to read. But we try to keep on top of things, and this is a very intriguing idea, because when this whole house of cards comes tumbling down, and people are impoverished, they're going to say, we're not going to trust the things as we have before. And so then, of course, this would be the time to have a gold-backed currency that actually did have in backed by something of intrinsic value. And certainly we can't trust exchange-traded funds. I think they're going to be used to rig the gold market for the time being.
Yep.
You think that's true?
I believe the ETFs were created to do just that. Not only that, they were created to manipulate the market, but they were also created so when you have the market drop 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 points and people do run, they will be able to put them into something that they can control. And for the people that aren't smart enough to take physical possession of their gold, they will get caught in that trap, and you know, the rest of their money will be taken from them, because that's what it's all about. They're there to take people's money. And the rules are not written for the wealthy. The rules are written against the people that they manipulate. And I do believe they will try to take everybody's wealth. Sure, a couple people might get lucky on the different investments. Maybe some people will get real lucky. But for the majority of the people that are involved in anything that has to do with Wall Street, I believe will be stripped of their wealth. And the only way they can protect that from happening is by purchasing gold and silver.
Well, you know, there's a man who would agree with you. He wrote an essay back in 1965, yeah, in which he said, in the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation to inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare state's tirade against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. And I know, I bet you know who said that.
Did his name begin with a G?
Oh, that's a Christian essay.
Alan Greenspan.
Alan Greenspan's one of the most famous essays of all time. Ladies and gentlemen, you can get it up on the Internet. Just go on the Internet and Google in Alan Greenspan on 1965. And I've summarized the most important part of the essay. It's not too long, but it's very straightforward. Alan Greenspan has recently said, he had read the article, reread it recently. He wouldn't change a word of it. He understands what's coming down the line.
Sure, he created a large part of it.
Sure.
By knowing what he knew that in that essay, he was able to propel this country and the economy to where it is today by creating the bubbles that he created since his taking office of the at the Federal Reserve. So,
and of course, if you really believe in the elitist concept, then you have to impoverish the lower class of people. And you do that by destroying the value of their life savings, and by destroying the value of their pension fund, and destroying the value of their home that they depend on. And of course, this is exactly what is happening. And I think the housing prices are going to fall. I think many of the pension funds are going to largely disappear. I think the people who are holding bonds and annuities and CDs, as the value of the dollar falls, they in turn will be wiped out. All of these things, I believe, are in the process of happening. I wish I could say I might be wrong. I don't see anything out there that makes me believe I am. And people have to begin to position themselves to prepare for the difficult times, because, of course, when they come, there's not going to be anybody there to help them. And I'm afraid that the safety net that we think is going to be there, the government's going to have enough money. Ladies and gentlemen, our local governments are having real trouble because they're not getting in the tax money. Our county and our state governments are having real trouble wondering how they're ever going to be able to pay the pension obligations, that they have these tremendous pension obligations and they're not fiscally sound. And, of course, many times some of the states, for instance, New Jersey is going to have to sell off its turnpike just so that it can partially fund its pensions for a year or two. But what happens when that money's gone from this New Jersey turnpike? Then what do you sell off? And so they're selling off the infrastructure of America so we can continue living, you know, as if we were wealthy. But America has ceased to be a wealthy nation, because for too long we've been spending far more than we've been, we've been spending far more than we've been putting out, and you can't do that indefinitely. And the time eventually does come when the piper is going to have to be paid. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question, maybe you disagree. Maybe you think that this is just all alarmist talk and there's nothing to worry about. But Melody and I have been following this we've been following it together for 7 years, and so many of the things we've been talking about, and Bob Chapman and and the others you've been talking about are coming to pass right now. And I think we have to be in a position. I hope people are listening to what we have to say and at least taking some steps to protect themselves, and especially with the very real possibility that we're going to be in a massive war in the Middle East within a matter simply of months. And talking to one of my friends who's on his way back over there to monitor what's going on in the Middle East and will be gone for some months, he tells me that nothing has changed. It's only a matter of time before we're in a full-scale war with Iran and probably with Syria. And, of course, this will mean a major war in both the Near East and the Far East. Well, I should say the Near East and the Middle East. And people have no idea the consequences of going to war with the entire Muslim world. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. Melody, let's get out your number one more time.
It's 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188.
All right, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program, and got a great program in the next hour as well. Well, Melody, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, I did want to mention to the listeners, I've been getting some calls and some comments. Never trade your gold for paper investments. I know that's been happening. People are getting calls telling people you don't need to own gold, you don't have to store it, you don't have to worry about this, and blah, blah. And never trade your gold for paper investments. If you don't have new funds to place in paper investments, then you shouldn't be putting anything in paper investments, because you should never have to trade your gold for paper. You just offset what you originally started to do, is protecting your assets with gold. So never ever do that. And if you make sure that if you have to be in stocks, that offset it with gold. Owning about, you know, $500,000 or $800,000 in stocks and owning $5,000 in gold, you certainly aren't balanced. You don't have any, you're not hedging your paper investments with gold. So you should be at least 50-50 if you need to be in stocks. And that's if you need to be in stocks. I say get out of them. Why do you want paper investments? But for those that do, at least offset and hedge yourself with 50% in gold along with your stocks. I've been getting a lot of calls and complaints about dealers taking long times for delivery. 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months for delivery. There's absolutely no reason that there should be a six-month delivery.
Well, are they hoping the price will go down so they can buy it cheaper before they have the delivery? Is that the trick they're using?
I'm not sure. Usually when that's a situation, it's more... No, they're paying or robbing Paul to pay Peter. They don't have enough funds to do the delivery. So, you know, they put it off, and you know, the money that comes in July will pay for those who bought in May or February. So you have to be extremely careful, and if it takes that long, I wouldn't buy from them again. And I mean, I have a turnaround time of 10 working days. So, you know, 10 working days to 6 months, absolutely not. I had someone said that it was 3 months for some silver rounds. Is it hard to get silver rounds? Because that's what they'll tell you. They'll tell you that the product is difficult to get. Well, it's not difficult to get 200 silver rounds. So the squeaky wheel gets your gold. So if it takes longer than expected, I tell people to go right to the attorney general. Because it's your money, and you should get your product.
Okay, we're out of time. My guest has been Melody Cederstrom from DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net. God bless.
Good night,
Melody. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest has been Melody Cederstrom, we've been watching this for 45 years, and I think that, you know, after 45 years, I think this is the time we've all been concerned about. when the whole financial house of cards of a fiat currency begins to come tumbling down. It's going to happen sooner or later, and we don't know whether it's right now, but everything suggests in the next year or so why the whole house of cards is going to come tumbling down, and those who are inside are going to be in real trouble. If you've not yet seen my talk on the financial tsunami, actually it's a VHS or DVD, and then there's a syllabus that goes with that that gives you an understanding of all these terms and what is M3. That's the figure the government just doesn't want you to know about. They do not want you to realize they're massively increasing both money and credit in an effort to keep the house of cards from crumbling, at least for the time being. And then, of course, we have another, of course, syllabus on sustainable development that will tell you that they really want to get rid of most of the people in the world. And, of course, those that are left over will have a very low living standard. The term would be the living standard of the people of Eastern Europe. That's, of course, that comes from the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, and we've simply summarized it there for you, along with, of course, the Earth Charter, the meaning of this, all of these plans by the elite for us common folks. And, of course, there's a talk, Sustainable Development, the Road to World Government, and we have, of course, access to 4 tape sets and other information that will help you to really understand what's going on in the world today. But until you understand the spiritual forces that energize what is taking place, none of this makes sense. And so this is why, of course, we suggest my talk on Brotherhood of Darkness, my talk on the Forbidden Secret, that's the Forbidden Secret. And then, of course, there's the 4-tape set, or 4-CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret, which is a response to the program that is sweeping America called The Secret. How you can utilize your mind to manipulate your environment. And, of course, it's more than just the power of positive thinking, because, of course, you're opening up your mind to demonic possession. And when you allow the demons to come in, they will reward you, and reward you richly, but at a terrible price. Understand there is another dimension. You can contact the other dimension by using the techniques that are advocated. If you watch the DVD very, very carefully on The Secret, on one frame, it's only on one frame, you have to lock that frame in to see it, is the word Rosicrucian. And this is what it is. It's a Rosicrucianism. In fact, the whole program really was came from a Mrs. Esther Hughes, who wrote a book called The Law of Attraction. And Esther Hughes channels a demonic spirit named Abraham. And that's what it's all about. It's all about channeling and open yourself up to demonic spirits. That's why the 4-tape set, The Secret Behind the Secret, is so vitally important, because you probably know people who are into this new spirituality, and their lives have been transformed, and they really have. And they're so much happier now than they were before, or at least they think that they are. Well, if you'd like to know more about the spiritual battle, the things we talk about, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Because we really are involved in a spiritual war for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And if you're in Colorado, remember I'll be speaking in Colorado tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. I will be back in just a moment for the next talk here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, for the next hour, our guest is going to be Mr. William Grigg, who I've certainly never known personally, but I've certainly admired his writing for many years, and I got a chance to meet him a couple of weeks ago personally, and hearing him give a talk at the UROC convention in Southern California, and I was just so taken with him. We're so fortunate to have an opportunity to get him onto our program, and I hope we're going to get him on from time to time. He really has a tremendous understanding of what's going on. He, for many years, were you the senior editor of the New American? What was your official title, William?
Yes, I was one of two senior editors along with William F. Jasper.
All right, fine. The senior editor of the New American magazine, certainly one of my favorite magazines, one of the finest magazines put out. But William has a tremendous overview of what's going on, and he's going to talk to us today. Well, what are we going to talk about tonight?
I think one of the things that would be worth talking about would be some of the developments in this unfolding story of the purported terrorist plot to blow up JFK Airport in New York City.
All right, fine. There's certain things about that plot that somehow just didn't seem quite right, because almost all of these terrorist plots, there seems to be an FBI informant who's an agent provocateur who's egging everybody on to be involved in terrorism. If there is really a terrorist threat, why is there almost always an FBI agent there who's encouraging people to become terrorists? But you pick up the story.
Well, with respect to the specific instance here at JFK, you had a group of two men, actually three, who were arrested and one who's still being sought, and supposedly they planned to use some kind of an incendiary explosive device to ignite the fuel lines in the supply depot that provides the jet fuel for JFK International Airport. And in doing so, they were supposedly going to set off this huge explosion that would destroy much of JFK and probably a good part of Queens, New York as well. And after they were arrested a little more than a week ago, if I remember correctly, the assumption was that you were dealing with a terrorist plot that would have created catastrophe that would have dwarfed 9/11 in terms of the human damage and the economic consequences as well. It's what we were told. But within a day or so, some people, sober and experienced analysts, looked at the plot and looked at the physical elements of what it would have involved and concluded that there were two problems, the first of which is that the people who were arrested for this supposed conspiracy didn't have the necessary tools, connections, or experience to do what they planned to do. And the second problem was that if they had managed to do what they planned to do, the fire probably would have been contained before it did a whole lot of damage to JFK. And of course, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, there was in the middle of this entire unfolding criminal enterprise a confidential informant, somebody who was identified as a source in the criminal complaint. No further identification was given beyond describing him as somebody who had been convicted for drug trafficking about a decade ago, and more recently had been convicted under the RICO law, and was offering his testimony in exchange for leniency in the sentencing.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment as we begin to analyze this recurrent theme of people perhaps working for the government and encouraging people to become involved in terrorist activities. Were these people who were seriously considering it, or were they, of course, being approached by a fellow Muslim who gained their confidence and tricked them into making certain commitments that, in their right mind, they never would have? We'll be back in just a moment. Go right ahead with the story.
The thing about this confidential informant, and this is something you find so often in cases of this sort is that he had an incentive to tell the federal government specifically what it was the federal government was looking for. And it's my opinion that the people who are involved in the political element of the Homeland Security State want to find these supposed plots on a regular basis as a way of maintaining a sort of low-grade public fever over the threat of terrorism. I don't want to minimize the fact that terrorism is a terrible thing, but if you take a look statistically at what's gone on over the last, say, 30 years or so, it's pretty clear that terrorism is badly overhyped as a threat, 9/11 notwithstanding. Over the last decade or so, you've actually seen a greater number of fatalities of American citizens who have died at the hands of law enforcement than have died at the hands of terrorists. Now, admittedly, many of the American citizens in question were criminal suspects, but if you take a look at a larger perspective, say the last 40 years or so, statistically you're likelier to die from an allergy to bee sting or an allergy to peanuts or in a road collision with a deer than you are as a result of terrorism. But nonetheless, terrorism has been elevated to the top echelon of public threats, and I think that from time to time, by way almost of an infomercial, we have these highly televised, highly publicized episodes where supposedly the latest 9/11 plot has been thwarted, and I think that's what this confidential informant was inserted into this group to do. He wanted to find some way of confecting out of the discontent and odd statements made by these Muslim malcontents a grand plot to do some vast damage on the scale of 9/11. And one reason I think that he was one of the instigators here is something that's found in the criminal complaint once again, which is the admission that it was the federal informant, this convicted drug trafficker, and a fellow who had been convicted under the RICO law, which deals with organized crime. It was he who went out and purchased, presumably with taxpayer money, the video camera that was used to conduct video surveillance of JFK, which was the actual act in furtherance of the alleged conspiracy. In order to be prosecuted for conspiracy, there has to be some kind of an act, an overt act that furthers the plot. You can't simply be, under most circumstances, you cannot simply be put on trial for conspiracy on the basis of things you say. There has to be some overt act. The overt act that was specifically mentioned in the criminal complaint here was the video surveillance of JFK, and that was something facilitated by the federal informant. And so it looks to me like it was a case of somebody drumming up business for himself and business on the part of his federal handlers here. There's a little more to the story here, but I think if you take it to that far no further...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William Grigg was pointing out that certainly with this plot to blow up the airport, airport. Why? Here we have it, the federal informant who goes out presumably with federal money to buy the television camera, video camera that's going to be used to start taking pictures of the airport in preparation for blowing it up. Now, certainly the other people involved in the plot, they didn't have the money to buy a camera. But as long as the government bought the camera for them, and perhaps one of them did take some pictures of the airport facilities with the thought that maybe they were going to do something, but I suspect most of this was being suggested by the government, by the informant's handler, and the government is providing the money to get the video camera, to get these people to start taking pictures that could be used against them when they're going to prove that they were planning on blowing up the airports. You pick up the story there, please, William.
One element of the story that has received not a whole lot of coverage, but I think is key to this whole thing, has to do with this Russell DeFreitas, the fellow who's considered the ringleader of the plot. He's a 63-year-old former baggage handler at JFK. And he had said to the confidential informant that when he was working at JFK in the late 1990s, he was frequently able to have unfettered access to the entire airport, including places where supposedly he didn't have security clearance to go. And that was an element of the story that I ran by Diane Clayman earlier this week. Diane Clayman was a rookie customs special investigator at JFK in 1999 when she made the same observation. She thought it was perfectly appalling that people who had no background check, who may not have been legal citizens of the United States, had free run of the concourse and even access through what's called the sterile corridors, which bypass customs, there at JFK. She also found out that her customs supervisor and many of the other people working customs at JFK, which she calls the largest border crossing in the United States, that they were horribly corrupt and they were quite possibly skimming some of the proceeds of the occasional narcotics bust that would go on. She mentioned one incident in which an amount of cash, probably in the neighborhood of $200,000, was simply skimmed off one drug bust. A drug courier was found in the possession of narcotics and cash. And she noticed that the amount that was reported was significantly less than that which was seen originally at the time of the bust. And she made a sufficient nuisance of herself in the course of a couple of months. She was fired summarily, and she's suing the Customs Department for being wrongfully dismissed. And she is one of the most prominent whistleblowers here. But what she described is something that the supposed ringleader of this conspiracy had described as well, which is the utterly non-existent security protocols that govern people who have unrestricted access to airplanes at JFK Airport. And another element of the story that I think is very significant and that I ran past Ms. Klayman when I talked to her yesterday was the fact that Russell Freitas worked for Evergreen International Airline, which is a small private airline, Evergreen International Incorporated, which is based in Oregon, and which is a proprietary fund company for the CIA.
Now, this is supposedly the ringleader of this whole terrorist
plot?
Yeah,
Russell DeFreitas, the ringleader of this plot, the man identified as such.
Now, why would the ringleader of this plot have been a former, working for a CIA front organization? That's a coincidence.
Yeah, that is a really remarkable coincidence. And I bounced that off of Diane Klayman yesterday, and she said, yeah. That's something I'd learned as well, which means he was probably working at JFK as a drug smuggler. Because in her experience working with Customs, bear in mind, before she worked with Customs, she'd worked with the ATF. She had been a prosecutor for about 6 years, an assistant prosecutor in New York City, I think actually in Queens. She had been trained as an expert marksman. She had a very long and very impressive resume working with various law enforcement agencies. And she'd also worked in the private sector to try to acquit people who've been wrongfully convicted of crimes. So she's somebody who pursues justice for its own sake. But when she was working at JFK in 1999, she said there were many occasions when people who were drug couriers were given access through these sterile corridors past customs by people who worked for the airline industry. And more often than not, as she consulted with DEA and other people who were involved in the completely bogus war on drugs, she's come to conclude, she found out that these people were actually working for folks who had connections to the CIA. She says the CIA has always been involved in drug smuggling as long as we've had a CIA. Back when it was the OSS that was involved in narcotic smuggling, it's simply common knowledge in the circles that she inhabits. So when she found out that this fellow worked for Evergreen, she said, well, he was almost certainly involved in drug smuggling. And so the way that this works for me is that you've got the confidential informant working presumably for the FBI, who was a drug smuggler. You had Russell DeFreitas, who was the alleged ringleader of this supposed plot, who had worked for a CIA proprietary airline who was probably involved in some capacity in drug smuggling. You had the government controlling both ends of this orchestrated little melodrama that was this purported plot at JFK. And I think that's pretty typical of the way that the public's being manipulated here, where the government creates the poison and the antidote in the same laboratory, and from time to time a plot of this sort will be brought up and ritually displayed for public inspection so that all of us will cling all that more tenaciously to the government in search of security and succor.
I hate to say it, but I've seen this over and over again. The bombings there in Kenya and Tanzania were planned by a man named Muhammad Ali. And Muhammad Ali was actually an informant for the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
He's known as either a double agent or a triple agent or quadruple agent. But, I mean, he had planned the bombing there in Tanzania, and the government knew all about that. He had trained Osama bin Laden's bodyguards. He had actually been with Osama bin Laden many, many times. He also was working with a special forces unit in our own military. He had come from the Egyptian military. He supposedly had been picked up on at least one occasion and stopped by immigration coming into the country,
mm-hmm.
and then of course had been told to get hold of his FBI handler so he could come into the country because immigration was, he was released. And actually, I think the Discovery Channel put out a program on him called The Third Man, The Disappearing Man.
Yeah, well, in the case of this supposed plot of JFK, you've got another layer of that type of official complicity, or evidence, rather, that there was that kind of official complicity going back decades. The Trinidad and Tobago-based radical Sunni Muslim group that was supposedly involved in this plot is called Jamaat al-Muslimin, which I think means the United Muslim Front. And the head of that organization, a fellow by the name of Umar Abdallah, which is a very common name in Islamic culture, is somebody who was a Mujahideen fighter in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And he was somebody who most likely was on the CIA payroll back then. And he ends up in Trinidad and Tobago heading up this group that's involved once again in drug smuggling and radical political activism and is purportedly involved in this plot against JFK. So really there's nobody in this entire thing who doesn't have some kind of a colorable connection to the government that is supposedly protecting us from terrorism. And this whole thing reminded me powerfully of what happened back in 1990 when Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, the so-called blind sheikh, he looked sort of like a malignant Santa Claus with his little red and white hat and sunglasses. The fellow who was the spiritual leader of the cell that carried out the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, Ramzi Youssef and company. And that cell, of course, contained many people who had been trained by the Pentagon or who had connections to the CIA as well. He was allowed into this country in late 1990 in spite of the fact that his name was on a State Department terrorism watch list. He was able to get a visa at the consulate in Khartoum because on that particular day, in that particular on that particular afternoon, when he visited the consulate, the official he would normally have to consult, normally have to be interviewed by to get a visa, was out of the office, and he was replaced at this one specific hour by a CIA operative who was posing as a consular official. It was the CIA operative who gave Omar Abdelrahman his visa to come to the United States, where he began to organize the movement and provide spiritual advice to the movement that bombed the World Trade Center in early 1993. So time after time, you have this really interesting connection here where the CIA seems to be actively abetting, facilitating either outright terrorist attacks on our country or little melodramas of the sort that we just saw here at the JFK airport about a week ago.
In fact, that story about Rockman is actually covered in James Cooley's book on Holy Wars. He was a foreign correspondent for Christian Science Monitor, book written in 1999 on Holy Wars, and he told that story about how the CIA was instrumental in getting Rockman, who is a known terrorist, he's a known insider, involved in the murder of a Sadat, brought to the United States. Why would you want to bring a man like that to the United States unless you were trying to incite this radical form of Muslim faith?
Yeah, another source on that is a book by Jim Dwyer called 2 Seconds Under the World, Terror Comes to America, The Conspiracy Behind the World Trade Center Bombing. That book, I think, was published in about 1994, 1995, and it's out of print now. You can probably find it at a decent used bookstore, but this is something that has been confirmed by multiple investigators,
right.
Investigative journalists, and also congressional investigators have learned this as well. The thing is, you're dealing with something that could be considered clinical stupidity or maybe pathological self-destructive stupidity, but even stupidity of that sort can only explain so much. You know, the type of people who are the administrators of the CIA, the FBI, the various other elements of this huge and sprawling Homeland Security apparatus, there are many things, but they're generally not stupid. And so when you see behavior of that sort, I believe that something more malignant than pure stupidity is at work. You've got some kind of a design involved.
Well, I'm sure there is. In fact, I have been firmly convinced that the CIA was working for many years to cause a resurgence of this radical form of Islamic belief that had lain dormant for so long. We know USAID was funding the printing of Islamic textbooks to encourage this radical form of Islam. Anybody like that documented? We have a wonderful article from, of all places, the Washington Post, called The ABCs of Jihad. And all these textbooks were telling little Islamic boys how great it was to kill the infidels, how great it was to die, you know, fighting for Allah, killing the infidels. That's you and I, ladies and gentlemen. Why would you spend $51 million for textbooks to teach people how to hate Americans and to kill them? go right ahead there.
Well, it's an interesting point you bring up here about the fact that USAID and some other agencies of our government have been using taxpayer funds to propagate radical Islamic jihad. While we're talking about books that are exposés of the subject, there's a really good book that was published last year entitled Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam by Robert Dreyfus, who's an investigative reporter, I believe, for Mother Jones, which is a left-leaning journal, but it does some really good investigative reporting.
In fact, we actually carry that book. We
oh, good.
Available
okay.
For our
yeah.
listeners.
Yeah, the thing about that particular book that I found fascinating is the description of how the CIA actively propagated not only the radical jihad-oriented Islamic fundamentalism, but also that it was involved in propagating specifically the activism of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is sort of the granddaddy of all modern Islamic terrorist movements, and the seedbed from which sprang Al-Qaeda and other criminal syndicates, and, if you will, violent jihadist clubs of that variety. And there really isn't a movement of that sort that has not been nurtured by the CIA. You've got these people who are sort of like the Johnny Appleseeds of global jihad out sowing the seeds and nurturing them, and eventually, of course, you're gonna harvest things like 9/11 or other terrorist attacks. And it's the sort of thing, once again, that should make people reflect on exactly what's going on here, because it's never been the hallmark of stupidity to be doing things like this. You know, the consequences are predictable, and people of reasonable or even modest intellectual attainment should be able to predict what's going to happen if you nurture a radical group like that and then have a foreign policy that seems to be perfectly calculated to inflame resentment against the United States and provoke people into listening to the message of radical anti-Western jihad.
I agree with you totally. In fact, we keep trying to get people to look beyond the obvious and ask, why would the CIA consistently be doing things as a foster and encourage this radical form of Islamic belief, unless we were trying to create the best enemy money could buy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very good way of looking at it. I mean, if you're doing certain things that are going to have predictable results, then you shouldn't be surprised when you end up with what you predicted.
Right. Well, it's really very, very disconcerting. Of course, I'm sure that there's some of the people within the Muslim group can be trapped into this sort of thing. And, you know, when somebody comes to you as a fellow Muslim, he's talking about, you know, being, you know, doing something to the hated Christians and the Zionists who are killing our people. And, you know, you can just see how they would manipulate these people, especially if they're not very smart.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think though that a lot of people in the Muslim movement are beginning to realize that their movement, you know, is totally infiltrated, you know, by agent provocateurs. They don't know who to trust.
I do think it's important to point out that, of course, this is not the only community or subcommunity in which you find that type of manipulation going on. I mean, obviously, with the Muslim faith, which was born in conflict and which has always been sort of bellicose and inclined toward violent propagation of its tenets, from the earliest experience of the Muslim faith, that's been very much a part of it. It's not just that community where you find this type of active infiltration going on. You know, back in the late 1960s, there was this FBI, actually began in the 1950s, COINTELPRO, which was the counterintelligence program which specialized...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and Chris Williams has been talking about not only the infiltration of the Muslim movement and encourage this resurgence of this radical form of Islam, which is characterized by the Muslim Brotherhood, which was really rather insignificant until it began to be financed and helped by the intelligence agencies, and then, of course, it began to have more and more influence in the countless millions of dollars that have been spent by your intelligence agencies to encourage this radical form of thought and activity. And, of course, it feeds very readily upon certain people who are traditional Muslims, because the Muslim faith at one time was a very violent mm-hmm. faith, and there are tenets there that do believe in this idea of jihad and of killing the infidels. Well, then, because William was saying that though the intelligence agencies have infiltrated other organizations. And there was this movement. And what do you call that? COINTELPRO?
COINTELPRO.
Right, go ahead. What's that?
A program started actually in the late 1950s, if I remember correctly, in which the FBI was keeping very close watch on domestic political groups of various hues, not only, of course, the Marxist elements of the activist left, but also some other groups that were considered to be radical right organizations. The Ku Klux Klan in particular was targeted by the FBI, and it was common folk wisdom among people who belonged to groups like the Ku Klux Klan and also George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi movement, George Lincoln Rockwell being himself a federal informant, which I thought was sort of interesting. But the common folk wisdom was that if you have a group of people that get together and somebody shows up talking about blowing things up or hurting people, you can pretty much be assured that the newcomer is a federal infiltrator. They're always the most militant ones. They're always the ones who are trying to incite you to do something that would actually get you caught and prosecuted. And when the COINTELPRO profiles were made available for public inspection about 30 years ago, that folk wisdom was thoroughly vindicated, because we found out that it wasn't enough that we had problems with groups like the Black Panther Militia, which I do consider to be a very violent quasi-terrorist group, organized loosely on Maoist principles and sort of filtered through the lens of black nationalism. Not bad enough that we had groups like that who were causing problems for law-abiding people, but you had the federal government actively inciting them to do things that helped temper the public mind and make it more receptive for a more aggressive and more militarized approach to law enforcement. I mean, the modern SWAT concept, special weapons and tactics concept, where you have these elite groups within police departments that are really militarized strike forces, strike teams, they become a pestilence in our country right now. It's a horrible thing, but there is not a day that goes by. I'm not exaggerating in one whit here. There's not a day that goes by in this country that you do not have a SWAT team kicking in the door of a home in which innocent people are doing nothing to harm anybody, and having these people thrown to the ground with a boot on the back of their neck or otherwise subjected to humiliation and torment is a result of being sent to the wrong address, because SWAT teams are being used more promiscuously than ever to carry out routine service of warrants and also no-knock raids in pursuit of narcotics and all kinds of things. They're always looking for excuses, local police administrators, to use the SWAT teams, the tactical teams. Where did the SWAT teams come from? Well, they were created in the late 1960s by Darrell Gates, when he was not yet the police chief of the LAPD, to deal with urban unrest. And this was in the aftermath of the Watts riots and some of the other really profile or headline-grabbing examples of urban unrest and violence. And that urban unrest was being inflamed by people who were radical elements of the black power community, like the Black Panthers. As a matter of fact, the very first use of the SWAT team was in the confrontation with the Black Panthers in Compton, I believe. And at that time, the commander of the SWAT team, I mean, Darrell Gates was in charge of the SWAT team, he had to call, practically had to call the White House to get specific permission to request that Camp Pendleton provide the SWAT team with a single grenade launcher, because the SWAT team was, if not outgunned by the Black Panther militia in the shootout that lasted most of an afternoon, they were at parity with them, and they wanted to find some way of making the Black Panthers quit. Well, as it happens, the Black Panthers relented, and the siege was ended without the use of a grenade launcher. But when this request was made, Darrell Gates and company knew that they were brushing up against a very important barricade which separates the police from law enforcement from the military. And this was once again as a result of a confrontation with the Black Panthers, and the SWAT movement began as a response to what was going on with urban unrest. And the reason why there was so much urban unrest in the time, if you go back and look at the COINTELPRO documents, is that the federal government was actually abetting this through the use of infiltrators and agents provocateurs who were helping to radicalize some of the already radical black power groups and move them more in the direction of outright insurgency. That was the reaction. The SWAT team, rather, was the reaction. The SWAT ethic was the reaction to this provocation, I believe.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with William Drake. You go right ahead. I think it's fascinating. Sydney, I'm sure you're absolutely right. I mean, you get you create a problem, and then you can create a counter to that problem.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we can justify the SWAT teams, and yet, of course, they're in response to a problem that has been artificially created. So go right ahead.
If not artificially created, it's certainly exacerbated through federal intervention here. That's, once again, something that we have learned as information has been disclosed to the public about what was going on with COINTELPRO, this covert program by the FBI. And you've got the action on the part of the radical groups that have been further radicalized through federal intervention. The reaction is the creation of militarized, specialized teams from major metropolitan law enforcement agencies such as the LAPD, which created the first SWAT team in the late 1960s. Now, practically every community in this country has a SWAT team or a tactical team or something modeled on the hostage rescue team from the FBI or something even more militarized than that. And most of the law enforcement agencies in this country, including in towns such as Payette, Idaho, which is the community where I live, Payette County has a tactical response team. And Payette itself is a town with fewer than 8,000 occupants, and yet we have something akin to a SWAT team. You wouldn't think it would be necessary, but there it is. And most of these agencies are receiving not only training from the likes of the Army Rangers and Delta Force operators, Navy SEALs, and so forth, but they're also receiving hardware and subsidies through the Department of Homeland Security and through the Pentagon through a program called the Law Enforcement Support Organization, or LESO. And they can apply, your typical small-town police department can apply to receive just about any kind of military hardware that their hearts desire. They're encouraged to acquire it, and they get it at either fire sale prices, they get it for free through federal grants, on the assumption that by receiving this hardware, they become affiliates of the Department of Homeland Security and or the Pentagon. If you receive help through the Pentagon's LESO agency, for instance, your police agency is considered to be an affiliate of the Department of Defense. So you have the full-bore militarization and federalization of law enforcement, which is the consummation of this process that began in the late 1960s, where the federal government was working to radicalize these groups and thereby provide the pretext for the militarization of the police. And I think the same kind of thing is happening right now with respect to these terrorist plots that bubble to the surface of public awareness from time to time, the JFK plot, the so-called plot to attack Fort Dix. And in the case of the plot to attack Fort Dix, once again, you have another federal agent provocateur. I wouldn't call him an informant or a confidential source.
Hold that thought right there, please, William. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Before we go on, William, I'd like you to give out your webpage how people can get in touch with you and get more information from you.
The easiest way to read what I've been writing and otherwise putting out in terms of radio commentaries, for instance, that I do every weekday, is to go to rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's rightsourceonline, one word, .com. That will take you to the Right Source, which is the media news portal that will include not only regularly updated news stories and commentaries, but also it will take you to Kevin Shannon's radio program. I'm a regular guest host every Friday on his radio program, which is called The Right Source Radio. And then my personal blog, which is Pro Libertate, that's Latin for freedom. It's also the motto on the Wallace family crest, as in William Wallace from Braveheart. My oldest son is named William Wallace, so you can guess what my favorite movie is. And also there's an email or an e-journal that is sent out by email called Pro Libertate that comes out roughly every month. And that's available for free. So go to Right Source Online, and that'll take you right to this entire collection of things that we're putting out by way of hopefully reasonably cutting-edge journalism. A lot of investigative reporting is going into the blog right now, and I'm going to be expanding to a couple of other outlets as well for the purpose of investigative journalism. And my new book, as soon as it's available, as soon as it's in print, should be available through Right Source Online. The book is entitled From Republic to Reich, How the Imperial Executive Devoured the Bill of Rights. So rightsourceonline.com is where you should go if you're interested in seeing more of what we have to say.
Is that Kevin Shannon's website?
Yes. Yeah.
All right, fine. Well, Kevin's a good friend. And
he's a wonderful man.
Great job.
Yes, he does.
And about it for a long time. Anyway, Pierce, our guest is William Cragen, simply pointing out that what has happened is, on one hand, you have the government creating these problems. On the other hand, of course, you have a response to those. And, of course, here we find the militarization of our police force. And our police force forming SWAT teams, already becoming almost an extension of the federal, instead of being local police,
mm-hmm.
now they are federal police, which is the last thing our founding fathers ever wanted. They wanted our local police to be answerable to the local people, to defend the local people. They were public servants, not to become part of an extension of an autocratic federal government that seems intent upon regulating every aspect of human endeavor. So,
yeah, under the scheme created through the Constitution, you go back to Federalist Paper number 45, I believe, which James Madison explained this. The federal government didn't have a whole lot of law enforcement authority because there are only a couple of things mentioned in the Constitution that were considered federal crimes. I mean, treason was considered a federal crime, for instance. You didn't have this immense superstructure of prosecutors and law enforcement agencies and regulators and people of that ilk envisioned in the Constitution. For instance, you wouldn't have had this whole retinue of U.S. attorneys and the Bush administration's politicization of the U.S. attorneys to the Justice Department has become a matter of some controversy in recent weeks because some of them had been selectively fired, apparently because they were considered to be something other than blindly partisan acolytes of the Bush administration. And I think it's scandalous to fire somebody for that reason, but I think we should fire the entire corps of U.S. attorneys because there's no constitutional justification for having them. If you're going to be prosecuting a federal offense, there are only a couple of things that really meet the qualifications of the Constitution to be prosecuted, then what the federal government should do would be to go to the district where the crime allegedly was committed. This is what the Constitution requires. And then retain the services of a local prosecutor, a county prosecutor, or some state attorney to act as the federal prosecutor for that specific offense. That's how they should operate, but that's not how they operate right now. But as Madison pointed out, the powers given to the central government were few and defined, and the powers retained by the states were numerous and indefinite and included everything having to do with what we now call law enforcement. Those were to be within the realm of reserved powers exercised by the states and by the subordinate elements of the states, the counties, and the cities, and so forth. And really, when you look at our history, in the Anglo-Saxon common law tradition, really, the only local law enforcement officer who has an office that has roots in that common law heritage is the sheriff. And the posse, of course, would be the local militia, would be mobilized by the sheriff when the contingency required that he do so. That's how the system operated in our country well into the 19th century. It was in the early 1800s that Robert Peel and some other people in Great Britain created the first professional police. London, the city of London, this is something I just learned recently, had huge riots in 1779-1780 because of economic upheaval and social turbulence, a lot of it having to do with the war against the American colonies. The city of London, being one of the largest cities in the world, didn't have a police force. It didn't have a police force until about 40 or 50 years later. And they were able to maintain public order in cities like London, like Philadelphia and the colonies at the time, without a professionalized police force because it was just not something that occurred to people that you needed to have a team of uniformed people who would be carrying out the functions of law enforcement. You simply had other ways of maintaining order. A lot of them have to do with this office of sheriff. Now, we have local police, or at least we used to have local police. That was an improvement on what we have now, actually, which is where local police agencies are, in everything but name, wholly owned subsidiaries of the federal government. They're local franchises of a unitary homeland security apparatus. And we need to step back from that immediately, because if we don't, we're going to end up in a situation where we literally have an army of occupation in all of our communities that is operated out of Washington, D.C., funded by Washington, D.C., beholden to Washington, D.C., not at all accountable to the communities in which these people operate. And that is the worst of all possible worlds, because the purpose of that type of a law enforcement entity is not to protect the rights and property of the citizenry, but to defend the interests of the state. And that is obviously the direction we've been heading for a number of decades, and I think we've already reached the point where we are living under the opening phase of that kind of a system. And I once again urge people to do what they can to try to restore local accountability over your police departments and your state police departments as well. And that has to be done right away, because if this gets set in concrete, it's going to take a really violent and cataclysmic upheaval to break up that system before it suffocates us.
Amen to that, because the definition of liberty was limited government. And
yes.
Of course, you could only have limited government if you have moral people. One of the problems we have is, of course, there's been a conscious effort to destroy the morality of our people, and, of course, to create a sense of lawlessness, knowing full well that when liberty leads to a loss of order, then the demand for order will lead to a loss of all liberty.
Mm-hmm.
But you go right ahead, will you?
You know, Cicero defined liberty as the existence of laws that are few and easily understood. And really, when you think about it, if you study the New Testament, which really is the New Testament, the Book of Deuteronomy, and the Old Testament are really the two most important source documents for the American understanding of law, justice, and how a political system should be run. The great lawgiver who spoke the law through Moses at Sinai gave us the Ten Commandments and elaborated on the principles in Deuteronomy, which was the most widely read passage of biblical scripture throughout most of the pre-independence history of the American colonies. But in the New Testament, that same lawgiver reduced the Great Commandments to reduce the commandments to two commandments, basically two laws, which, you know, love God with all your heart and might and strength, and then love your neighbor as yourself. And on these two principles hung all the law and the prophets, he explained. Well, the thing is, that's a really easily comprehensible statement of how society should be organized. And all laws that are laws worthy of obeying, and this is sort of the Blackstone perception on or perspective on how law should operate, all laws actually should be rooted in God's law, which is to say, to paraphrase Blackstone again, would be revelation and the law of reason. And the laws which are contrary to God's law are really not laws at all, they're enactments whereby men exercise power over each other. And in our system of government, as it was originally constituted, there were not that many laws. You did not have the government invasively regulating the behavior and actions and attitudes of individuals to anything like the extent that we see today. It would have struck our founding fathers as abhorrent, for instance, excuse me, that the central government would be dictating land use policies that trickle down to the county and local level, or presuming to tell people they had to be carrying papers with them in order to travel, as you do at airports today. I mean, literally, you cannot travel by airplane unless you're carrying federally recognized identification documents. And with the Real ID Act, which is supposed to go into effect next year, it's going to get to be the case that if you don't have a federally suitable national biometric ID card, which is what your driver's license would become, you won't be allowed to board an airplane. You have to have that specific form of ID. I really believe that the time will come that if you live in a state, as I do, where the state government has indicated its unwillingness to implement the Real ID Act, if you have a driver's license issued by that state, and you travel outside that state to another that is part of the Real ID program, and you're stopped by a cop for a traffic violation, chances are you're going to get arrested for having an invalid driver's license, which is another way that the federal government is going to cut down on the freedom to travel. And that brings up another issue I've written about quite a bit, which is the fact that in the life experience of most of us, the place where we're likeliest to find ourselves confronting the business end of government, meaning somebody with a gun who has the discretionary power to inflict physical harm on you, up to and including killing you, the circumstances where we're most likely to run into such a person is when we're driving. And driving, you know, the freedom to travel by automobile is one of the defining elements of the American way of life, and it has been for over a century. And I think that it's fascinating to see the multifarious ways that the federal government has been using that right against us by, for instance, using these highway bills, which are funded by these extravagant taxes on gasoline that we pay every time we fill up at the pump. using these highway bills to take control over state and local law enforcement agencies by giving them subsidies to conduct such things as DUI checkpoints, sobriety checkpoints, click-it or ticket enforcement routines, which are carried out two or three times a year. Random vehicle inspections to see if you're obeying seatbelt laws, the federal subsidies to law enforcement agencies at the state and local level through highway bills and so forth are being used to induce states to enact mandatory seatbelt laws. And that's the sort of thing I think that would have caused somebody like a Thomas Jefferson or a James Madison to rebel. The idea, if they understood what an automobile is, and I think that they were bright enough to understand the concept, even though they'd never seen one, the idea that somebody traveling in his own automobile and doing harm to nobody else could be arrested, conceivably, for refusing to wear a restraining device like a seatbelt. I mean, if you're not wearing a seatbelt in the state of Oregon, and I've had this experience, if you're not wearing a seatbelt in the state of Oregon and you're on an access road leading into a shopping mall, a police officer can pull you over and cite you, give you a ticket for something, in the neighborhood of a couple of $100s, because you've chosen not to wear a restraining device, and conceivably, all the worst that would happen is that you would get injured. You know, that's a matter over which the government has no proper jurisdiction. And yet, under the laws of Oregon and a number of other states, this is something the federal government has promoted. You know, you can be detained by a law enforcement officer and cited for not wearing a seatbelt. If you make an issue out of it, you could be hauled away to jail. I mean, that happens more frequently than most people would be willing to recognize. Somebody gets properly annoyed that he's being upbraided for choosing not to wear a seatbelt, and he can be hauled away to jail. I've met people like that. I know people who've been actually sent to prison for things of that sort. You know, they have traffic violations that result in their license being revoked, and they drive with a suspended license. They end up in prison. That used to be the case here in Idaho until the law was changed about a year ago. But all these things would have struck our founding fathers as utterly abhorrent and completely incompatible with the system of ordered liberty that they thought they were creating when they gave us our Constitution. And things are not going to get any better. The trend lines are really pretty discouraging right now, unless people can somehow wrap their mind around a couple of basic principles, the first of which is that the government should not be in the business of doing anything other than protecting the lives and the property of the law-abiding, meaning people who do not do injury to the laws, to the lives and property of others. That's the only thing government should be doing. And the second thing that people have to realize is that anything the government does, any role that it assumes in society, is backed up by the implicit threat of lethal force. When you want the government to do something, you should ask yourself, is this something I'm willing to kill for? That's how government operates. Everything it does is backed up by the implicit threat that if you do not submit to the will of the government as embodied in whatever government official you're dealing with, they reserve the power to kill you in order to punish you for your refusal to submit. So if you're going to authorize the government to do something, ask yourself, am I willing to see somebody killed in order for this to be accomplished? If people would just understand those two concepts and start acting on those concepts, I think we can start doing some real damage to the plans of the people who intend to rule us.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that what we really need to get people, the average individual, to understand is that there really are people out there who would like to rule us. There really are people out there who have a different worldview, who want an authoritarian society in the United States, and certainly want to do away with our sovereignty and merge us into a world government, and want to change our religion, and want to change everything, because they have a whole different world perspective. That is, of course, what most people find it difficult to believe. They believe everybody's just as nice as they are, and the tragedy is they're not.
My dad has that problem, by the way. My dad is a wonderful man. I don't think that he's ever spent more than maybe a minute or two in self-preoccupied concerns. He's been unselfish and as honest as anybody I've ever met. He is the most benevolent person I've ever known, and he makes the mistake of believing that everybody is fundamentally like himself, except, of course, for the so-called Islamofascists. He's convinced that the only way we're going to deal with those people is by wiping them all out, and the reason why he believes that is because the people who rule us have said so, and he just can't quite conceive of the reality that the people who rule us are a bigger threat to us than the people that supposedly threaten us from outside. And Dad just assumes that everybody is as benevolent as he is. I think that's a very common failing on the part of a lot of Americans.
And, of course, it's exactly the opposite of what the Bible teaches, that man basically is evil in his heart. And the other thing is, of course, that they've created a new word. It's called Islamofascism.
Uh-huh.
And isn't it amazing how that word is caught on? It's almost as if somebody is programming that that word into our vocabulary,
yeah,
into our minds and hearts. And, of course, if we're not careful, Osama bin Laden and the Islamofascists are going to get us unless we give all power to government. Well, our guest has been William Gregg. It's always a pleasure to have you. And we've got just a couple of more minutes, and then we'll be finishing up the program for this evening here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
I think it's interesting you brought up this newly coined term, Islamofascism, because that's a really good example of a piece of verbal artifice of the sort that's meant to stop discussion. I call these thought stoppers. The idea that in dealing with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and groups of the sort that supposedly are represented by this purported plot at JFK, we're dealing with the lineal descendants of the Nazis. And the thing is, there is such a thing as Islamofascism, and I think that Saddam Hussein would have qualified, but the thing is, Saddam Hussein was somebody who was supported by the United States government. The United States government has been in the business of supporting Islamofascism, meaning ruling elites and government regimes in places like Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East that operate their economies in a corporatist fashion, corporatism being Mussolini's creation of this hybrid of the big central government power and selective corporate entities that are wedded to the government. Saddam Hussein operated his economy that way. The Saudi hierarchy operates their economy that way. Most of the petro tyrannies in the Gulf region operate their economies that way, and they've all been supported by Washington. Whereas the people in the private realm who are criminal syndicates such as Al-Qaeda are not Islamofascists because they don't seek to build and consolidate the state. They seek to tear it down. And in order to be a fascist, you have to subscribe to Mussolini's dictum of everything within the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. That's certainly not the case with the people like Al-Qaeda who are non-state actors. It would be actually more accurate to call them Islamo-Leninists, but the problem is that we also have Leninists who are running our government, people whose political pedigree goes back through the so-called neoconservatives of the 1970s, who are all disciples of Leon Trotsky, who himself was a disciple of Vladimir Lenin. And they believe in consolidating power through criminal means, and then once they have obtained power through their terrorism or through their violence or through their subversion, then they consolidate power in a ruling elite that claims the right to rule without any kind of legal restraint. That more or less is the doctrine of the Bush administration, the unitary executive doctrine. The president basically is our living constitution. His word and his writ are our law. We have to study to make his will our law. That's a concept really that has more to do with Lenin than with Madison. And the casual use of the term Islamofascism, I think, is very much a piece of programming, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan. I think that's a really good example of how...
I'm going to have to let you go. We're out of time.
Okay.
It's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed having you. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. God bless. Right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed having William Gregg on with us. I think he's got a tremendous amount to offer, and I hope we can get him on a regular basis here on Radio Liberty. And we try to bring you people of that quality who've thought these things through and can express themselves well, and certainly William Gregg can certainly express himself very, very well. Well, under any circumstances, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we depend upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day by radio, by shortwave, by internet, by satellite, and to about 60 outlets. We reach a lot of people, and we'd like to keep on doing that. In fact, we'd like to expand, but right now we've got to preserve what we've got, and with your help we're going to do it. So if you're interested in joining the Radio Liberty family, don't hesitate to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you live in Colorado, I will be speaking there tomorrow evening at the Rinalda Theater. If you would like more information, you can just call our 800 number, and they can tell you, give you the number of the people to contact, or I'll give it to you right now. There's a couple of young men who have made the arrangements. Their number is 970-346-3742. That's 970-346-3742. And we're looking forward to seeing those of you who can make it. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will begin to do your homework and begin to understand we're really moving away from freedom towards fascism here in the United States. It is not happening by accident. There are powerful spiritual forces as well as ideological forces behind what's taking place. If you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, if you've not yet seen our talk, VHS, a DVD, on the Forbidden Secret, let me recommend that to you. Certainly DVDs, where I appear, although a very, very small part, in The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning and Riddles in Stone. Vitally important to begin to put together the various dots on the screen so you can begin to understand what's happening. Incidentally, The Forbidden Secret does have a syllabus with it. It has a lot of the speeches we talk about, the president's speeches, where he talks about the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. The angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. What in heaven's name is President Bush talking about? Well, you want to get the book, you want to get the syllabus, you want to get the talk, and you'll begin to sense what we're really dealing with today. And that is a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. So, then of course, we hope that many of you are making preparations for the difficult times that I believe lie ahead. I believe, of course, we're moving towards a war with Iran. I hope and pray that I'm wrong, but everything points in that direction. A war with Iran, a war with Syria, a war with the entire Islamofascist world. And, of course, I don't believe that the average Muslim wants a war with the West. I don't believe the average Iranian wants a war with the West. I don't believe the average American wants a war with the Muslim world, because it's going to bring terrible and disastrous consequences to our economy and to our nation. But I believe there are people out there who have been planning this war for a long time. And, of course, if you read our material, you'll understand why. If you have not yet read our February 2007 newsletter, it's available at RadioLiberty.com. That's February 2007. If you don't have access to it, we'll be glad to send you a copy. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until, well, I guess it's Monday now, when we'll be back with you once again here at Radio Liberty, this is Dr. Stan saying goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.